being, your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're hearing now our second case for the April sitting. And before I call that case, let me introduce to you all East Troy High School's students who are here with us today. Would they please stand? You may be seated. Thank you for coming this morning. The students are here with our Court with Class program. This program is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. And we invite high school students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. And if the school accepts this invitation, the students are given materials about the case, briefs, and they may have done extra work on this case, and then come to court to hear counsel argue the case. And then as the last part of this program, at noon after the second case, the students and everyone else invited to meet with a justice of the court who will discuss the procedures of the court in deciding cases, hearing and deciding cases, not the substance of this case. So let me introduce the justices to you, and I'm going to start on my far left with Justice Patience Rogensack, and she is the justice with whom the students will meet after this case finishes. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser, and to my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is an empty chair, and ordinarily Justice John Wilcox sits there. And then is Justice Patrick Crooks, and next to Justice Crooks on his right is also an empty chair in which Justice Diane Sykes ordinarily sits. They like Justice Crooks. That's not why they are here.
I feel a bit lonely.
I know. Well, listen, just feel free to move up those ranks. I thought you looked lonely. All right.
I think it's a timeout or something. No.
They've been sent to their rooms. All right. I'll now call our second case, 02-1974, Central Corp versus Research Products Corporation. Representing Central Corp is Daniel W. Hildebrand. You have 25 minutes and 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. With me at the counsel table is Jack Kelly, a distinguished lawyer from the Dempsey firm in Oshkosh who worked on this case. The court should know that Jack and I grew up about one block from each other, and Jack had the brains to go back to Oshkosh. But I stayed here. But Jack has been a good friend for many years, and he's an excellent lawyer. For the benefit of our high school students, I remember when I was in high school, I read Julius Caesar, and I'm going to start my argument by paraphrasing Julius Caesar in Mark Anthony's speech. We have come here not to bury Ziegler, but to praise it.
Chief Justice will like that.
And I don't.
Am I relieved, Mr. Hildebrand?
But it's really true. Ziegler was decided back in 1987, and apart from the Baldwin case, this court has not really had the opportunity to address the fair dealership law and how the term community of interest should be interpreted. And since Ziegler, we've had a lot of federal court decisions out of the district courts in the Seventh Circuit, which have what I would say is purported to follow Ziegler, but they have also created some tests that make it very, very difficult for or more difficult for a dealer to enforce its rights under this statute. And what I would like to focus on today is to ask this court to return back to the court's opinion in Ziegler, because it's an excellent opinion and it lays out all of the things that should be considered in the community of interest analysis, and not follow what some of these nuances and more difficult requirements that have been imposed by case law in the federal courts. And what essentially happened in this case is that our Court of Appeals and the decision below took the standards that have been developed in the federal court cases subsequent to Ziegler and have made it much more difficult for dealers to succeed in these dealership cases. And it is our view that this is contrary to the purpose of the statute. And if you look at the opinion of the court below, you will see that it cites the Freiberg case and the Kenosha liquor case, and I'll get into that later.
Mr. Hildebrand, if I might interrupt you for a minute, you mentioned the community of interest analysis, and I find that a difficult term to get my arms around, to really understand. How would you define that particular term? Because that seems to be at the core of the analysis and as to whether or not there is indeed a dealership in this particular case.
Well, the community of interest, as the court stated in Ziegler and has been stated in other cases, is a difficult concept to analyze and grasp. But what it does mean is that, as the court said in Ziegler and following from the statute, there has to be a continuing financial interest, and as well as interdependence, and there has to be something of essence in the relationship between the grantor and the dealer that will take it out of the category of a simple vendor-vendee relationship. Now, in light of the opinion in Ziegler, which outlines 10 facets that are to be considered and the goals of the statute and all of that, we think, of course, that in this case, Central has met the community of interest standard. And one of the essential problems in this case is that I'm sure the court is familiar with the record that was made in summary judgment, a big envelope. And what has happened here and in some of these other cases, and particularly in federal court cases, is that dealership cases are now tried by affidavit. And that deprives the dealer of a full-blown trial where the inferences as to whether or not there is a continuing financial interest and interdependence can be adjudicated. Now, the public policy underlying the statute, I think, has also somewhat gotten out of whack. One of the public policy indicia in the statute is that we have to protect the dealers from from the economic power of the grantor, the large corporation, the more powerful corporation that can come in and get people to distribute its products and so on and so forth. But the other purpose that's been lost sight of and that I would like this court to also consider is that there is a strong public interest in fairness of the of protecting the dealers in this kind of a situation. And this is the public policy of the state of Wisconsin. When you look at the federal cases that came after Ziegler, you will see how the federal courts have viewed it. They will say, for instance, maybe the statute is contrary to the free market economy because people can't do what they want. But, of course, the legislature...
Isn't it contrary to the free market economy?
That's, I think, what the view is because the free market economy would say, okay, if a grantor wants to drop one dealer and take on another under free market economy, if it's profitable to do so, that's fine. Yes, it is contrary. But like many statutes on the books, going from you know, labor legislation, child labor, what have you, the legislature has created public policy to ameliorate and make our economy fair. And that is one of the things that the dealership statute does.
Oh, is that constitutional?
Pardon me?
Is that constitutional?
Yes, it is. The Constitution does not prohibit states from legislating for the public interest in regulating the free market economy. This is a regulatory statute which is, represents important public policy. Governor Lucey called it the Magna Carta for the small businessmen of this state. Whereas the Seventh Circuit has said, and I will refer you to Moore versus Tandy, well, this is protectionist legislation.
It is.
Well, I'm not so sure that it is. It protects dealers from unfair treatment, but it's not designed to fence people out and to protect somebody that doesn't deserve protection, because the dealership statute says that if the dealer isn't performing, that there's good cause to terminate, then the dealer can be terminated. So in that sense, the dealer is not protected. The dealer is not frozen
not
in or the grant.
Absolutely protected, but is relatively protected, because right. In a totally free market economy, he would not be protected. You have a contract, and it ends, or there is no termination date. You allow people to break off their relationships.
That's right. But what I'm trying to tell the court here is that this is important public policy that's important to the state, and that the legislature has enacted it, and it should be enforced by the courts.
Mr. Hildebrand, what's wrong with trial by affidavit in this kind of a case? It seems to me that many of the issues are undisputed. You can pretty well line up the relationship from a financial point of view. There's testimony, for instance, on the record through affidavits in regard to a percentage of gross profit, a percentage of a net profit, percentage of sales as against overall revenues. Why can't you try this kind of case by affidavit?
Well, in some cases, you could try them by affidavit. But to return back to Ziegler, one of the problems in Ziegler was that there was a dispute as to the warehouse that was built. And the grantor said, well, you ought to build that warehouse anyway, and you were using the warehouse to have other things in it. Well, my client had a new facility built and leased it, and it was financed by the owners personally. The trial court says, well, you know, that wasn't dedicated specifically to this product, and therefore it doesn't count. Well, you have a dispute as to really what inferences should be drawn from this warehouse, just like you had in Ziegler. And so these kinds of issues have to be tried. Now, what I would like to just talk about here a little bit is these two opinions, which were both cited in the Court of Appeals. In Kenosha Liquor, the court says that one of the things that has to be done is that there either has to be a large portion of the business committed to a supplier, or the reseller has substantial assets specialized to the supplier's goods. Ziegler doesn't require that, never did. And then in Freiburg Farm equipment, the Seventh Circuit said basically the same thing, where a large proportion of the dealer's revenues are derived from the dealership, or where the alleged dealer has made sizable investments in, et cetera, fixed assets, inventory, advertising, training, specialized in some way to the grantor's goods or services, and hence not recoverable. And it was these two cases that the Court of Appeals focused on in affirming the judgment here. Now, I would like to compare that with what this Court said most recently in the Baldwin case. And there, the Baldwin case, I think, made it very clear that where a and I'm quoting from it at paragraph 27 in that case, when a dealer seeks substantial relationship resources into its relationship, time, money, employees, facilities, inventory, advertising, training, or derives substantial revenue from its relationship, or some combination of the two, then the community of interest is satisfied because the grantor's power to terminate, cancel, can become a threat to the economic health. That's what we have here. That's exactly what we have here. There is nothing in this court's opinion that talks about the specific attachment to specific resources. Now, here you have a situation where you have a manufacturer, and I want to talk about this business of continuing financial interest. My client was a distributor here for 20 years. The defendant had absolutely no way of getting his product, its product to market, no trucks, no delivery system, and my client did all of that. How could there be more of a continuing financial interest or independence than that? Some of the cases of this court, such as Kania and Forrester, emphasized that there had to be some investment, and these cases were lost by the dealer simply because the dealer was a middleman, not undertaking any risks. Again, here, all of this inventory was purchased by my client, who took the risk of having to sell it. And that element is not present in Kania, nor is it present in the Forrester case. So this, and then, you know, spare parts.
I thought that here your client sold to a middleman who ultimately sold to the consumer, and that the corporation, the defendant here, did most of the advertising and most of the work in getting this middleman to buy its goods. Am I wrong?
Partially.
Okay. Well, half right is not bad.
Right. We'll go 50-50. It is true that Research Products did most of the advertising and that my client did very little on the advertising end, but it was my client that bought the goods and developed the market through these installer contractors. In other words, Research Products didn't go out and get the installer contractors. My client did that. And my client made the deliveries. And my client made the sales calls. And so on and so forth. My client carried the spare parts so that if there was a spare part that was needed, it was there, it was delivered right away. So that's what it was.
Well, I've got you interrupted. I understood this case to raise the issue, maybe two issues. One, is summary judgment ever permissible in these dealer franchise cases where you have continued financial interest and continuity? And two, assuming that the answer to that is sometimes you can have summary judgment, which Ziegler said, is this a case in which summary judgment is acceptable? Is that the issue?
I think that's a fair statement, Your Honor. Right. Yes.
So it seems to me that your argument will be that there are material issues of fact in dispute, or if the facts themselves are not in dispute, then the inferences to be drawn therefrom are in dispute.
That's right? Correct.
Okay. Now, I gather from the argument thus far you've taken offense at the Seventh Circuit, and that you don't think they're following Ziegler. Well, we're now here in our court, and so I gather you want us to continue following Ziegler. But why not? Shouldn't you be telling us what material facts are in dispute or what inferences therefrom are in dispute so that you can go back and have a trial? Isn't that what you want?
Yes. Well, if you go back to Ziegler, First of all, my quarrel with the Seventh Circuit is that they have imposed standards on what has to be proved for the community of interest, which are not contained in Ziegler and which do not really jibe with Ziegler or the Baldwin statements, as they
are. I understand that one of the things they do is they require, or seem to require, a larger percent of profits or gross sales from the particular defendant, whereas Ziegler said that's an important factor, but not necessarily definitive. Right?
My real quarrel with the Seventh Circuit is not with the percentage of sale because or profits. Because
the other one is investment.
But what has to be invested in? What the Seventh Circuit says, it has to be specific to the product, whereas this court has said that that isn't necessary.
And I gather it's not only investment in property like a warehouse, but investment in time and training, et cetera, for employees.
Right.
Is that right?
That's exactly
okay.
Right. And the inferences, though, is there interdependence here under the facts of this case? And is there an appropriate inference of continuing financial interest? And, of course, we tell why there should be. But you see, one of the things that I think is very bothersome here is that, you know, we have the defendant who had 8 distributors in Wisconsin, and the defendant makes something that has to be installed with furnaces. So it goes out and tries to get good people like my client who are putting in furnaces, and so they can piggyback their product along with it. So my client for 20 years goes out and develops this name, and then all of a sudden they let him go. Now, is that a dealership? Do you have the interdependence when you have this kind of activity? The fact of the matter is that I don't think there's a serious question but that there was interdependence. But then the continuing financial interest, we fall down on the Seventh Circuit test because in this kind of piggyback operation, there isn't going to be specific assets dedicated to humidifiers. The humidifier will go out on the truck with the furnace and with the sheet metal and with everything else that goes on.
Counselor, I want to talk to you a little bit about that, about the way we look at the amount of money that your client achieved from these sales. Are we to look at it solely as an overall percentage of their sales for everything they do, or are we to look at it as a percentage of this particular kind of item, humidifiers and so forth, that they sell?
Well, if you look at it as a percentage of the humidifiers they sell, it's 100%. If you look at it overall, then it's about 7 or 8 or whatever it was.
I understand both of those answers, but my question is, how should we look at it and why?
Well, I think what you have here is an integrated operation by a company that sells and distributes furnace and furnaces-related equipment, sheet metal and the like, so that, and their customers are people that go out and put furnaces and humidifiers and whatever else is needed in a person's home. And these folks also go out and service it. The other day I got a $300 bill because my humidifier went bad and we had to have some work done.
Was it a name?
I called the furnace. Yes, it was. It's the only brand in town. So I had to have a new pump. So the furnace guy comes out but this is the way it works.
You know, my concern is, even if this goes back to a jury, I mean, just say you sold more than furnaces. Say you sold furnaces and you sold dishwashers. Pick something else out. And your furnace business was half of your total sales for your client, and your dishwashers were half of your total sales for your client. So now you've depreciated the amount down to probably 2.5% if you're going to look at gross sales. But I wonder, you have to be limited to just the overall sales of the company, or do you more, when you're looking at fairness, do more fairly look at what part of your business this item plays. And if you do that, you have two businesses, essentially, selling dishwashers and selling furnaces. So should I compare what you sell to just your furnace business? Then you're going to have twice as much. It'll be 10% rather than 5%. Do you see what I'm saying? I have,
yes.
I
think I can answer your question pretty well, and this gets to Justice Crooks's. Years ago, I had a case involving American TV, and we lost that case, and we didn't appeal, but American TV argued that they had all these different lines, furniture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and in their hi-fi department, they had a high-end amplifier that they were being terminated on. It was less than one-tenth, maybe even one-tenth of its sales.
Okay.
And they said, well, this is important for us to be a full-line thing. Well, we lost that case. That is the summary judgment case that Justice Crooks, I think, you would recognize would be appropriate on community of interest, because this was such a small drop in the whole bucket that it's not a dealership.
Whereas so essentially here, what you're telling me is that you're not apt to be a dealer if you carry a whole bunch of products and do a whole bunch of different things in your business, but you are apt to be a dealer if you do one thing.
That's right.
That seems odd to me.
But that's what we have here. Economically, that's what we have here. We have a company like Research Products that hooks up with furnace folks because it's an integral part of a furnace sales and installation operation. And then when that product, which has developed a brand name and all of that over the 20 years, is taken away, these people get hurt. And it's unfair and contrary to the purposes of the statute.
Well, do we look at how they're hurt in the sale of furnaces if they can't sell April Air, or do we look only at the loss of the April Air product?
I think you have to look at the overall impact on that business. It's like the trial judge said, this is very good, and because I think it proves our point, but he didn't buy it. He said, well, you know, if they cut off your arm, you could still write with your left hand. I said, Judge, he said, you need your both arms here to function. Well, he didn't buy it.
Yeah, no, but I guess I'm not making myself very clear. I'm trying to figure out how to analyze what you are presenting to us in terms of this particular case. And I'm trying to understand what your position is in regard to where you see the impact to your client by the loss of April Air. And if it's just the loss of that one product, I understand that from everything that's been submitted. What I don't understand or really see spoken too much is, are you contending through what you've put forth that you will lose sales to people that are going to install furnaces because they're going to buy
yes.
them from Sam rather than buying them from Central because they still want the April Air package?
That's exactly right, and there's evidence that we have presented in the record, and we discuss it in our brief, that it will hurt the other sales because these installers want to buy everything that they can do. Now, we have been criticized by our opponents for that because we haven't quantified it. We haven't quantified the fact that when a salesman goes out, he sells all of these things and so on and so forth. But my client has put in affidavits and the like that says that if he doesn't have this April Air line and there's no substitute for it apparently available to him, it's going to cost him other sales. Have we been able to prove how much? No. But for a person,
how much if you go back to trial?
Pardon me?
Will you be able to prove how much if you go back to trial?
I don't know. But these folks are out in the business trying to earn a living, and they say that the loss of the product is going to hurt them. And I think it's a common sense thing that makes a lot of sense. And we would like to tell a jury about that and let the jury draw its own conclusion.
Thank you.
Only one reasonable inference allowed here from all this evidence? Is that your position, that there's more than one reasonable inference jury could hold against you?
Are you asking me if the plaintiff is entitled to summary judgment on the dealership issue?
I've tried to.
Okay, well, I would say that there's plenty of evidence that would justify it, yes. But there are, of course, competing inferences about really, were they interdependent? Was there enough here? Was research really interdependent? So, in all candor, I think this is a case that should be tried. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Axe, representing Research Products Corporation.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Kenneth Axe. To my left is Michael Lawton of the law firm of Latham & Clark, another distinguished lawyer before the Court. we appreciate Mr. Hildebrand's vote of confidence in our product line, by the way. the issue before this Court is the application of the community of interest element of the Wisconsin Failure Dealership Law to the evidence. Can it be properly done here, or do genuine issues of material fact preclude summary judgment? And another way of putting the issue is whether the plaintiff that has the burden of proof of establishing that it is a dealer and a dealership put forth sufficient evidence on summary judgment to show that there was an issue to which it was entitled to a trial, that it could sustain its burden at trial, and therefore was entitled to that trial as opposed to summary judgment. We point out, by the way, with respect to the talk of trial by affidavits, there are depositions in this case. Mr. Gertz, who is an officer of the plaintiff, and there are, I believe, four depositions taken of research products personnel, and they're also part of this record.
Counsel, I just want to stop with regard to the burden of proof. Perhaps I misunderstood. The burden of proof for summary judgment is really on the non-moving party, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, yes and no, to paraphrase okay. Mr. Hildebrand. Following the United States Supreme Court's decision in Celotex and Anderson versus Liberty Lobby, this Court and others have said that where the moving party puts forth a case suggesting that the party with the burden of proof will be unable to make its burden at trial, similar to a directed verdict, in effect, at the conclusion of evidence, and time for discovery has gone by, which happened here, the burden then goes on the other party to show that, in fact, they do have a case. The one case I think of is the Court of Appeals, simply because I've used it in other briefs, Transportation Insurance Company versus Hunziker. But I think it was also well stated in a district court case, if I can just get to it, by Judge Stattmuller in the Eastern District. He said, even if some facts are in dispute, entry of summary judgment is appropriate if the movement either established uncontroverted facts entitling it to summary judgment or demonstrates that the non-moving party, that would be Central, has failed to make a sufficient showing on an essential element of its case with respect to which it will bear the burden of proof at trial.
Counselor, isn't there a different standard for summary judgment in the federal courts than we use in the state courts?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Okay.
For instance, I just have a couple of recent cases. I think both of them are our court. On summary judgment, we're required to draw all reasonable inferences in favor of the non-moving party. I think I wrote that a couple of years ago in a case. In a review of summary judgment motion, this court interprets the facts and all reasonable inferences drawn from those facts and in the light most favorable to the non-moving party.
I would submit that the federal courts do the same thing, Your Honor, and that in this case, reasonable inferences from the evidence were drawn to the extent they could be in favor of the plaintiff, the non-moving party. Where there was no evidence submitted on something such as quantification of time or dollars spent, in response to the Ziegler facets, such as percentage of time or revenue devoted, then the court cannot draw any inference from that and is left to find that, at least on that facet, the non-moving party hasn't shown it's capable of meeting its burden. Summary judgment is the time under this analysis where the party shows that there is a case for which it's entitled to trial. Not that material issues of fact are resolved, but that there are material issues of fact or conflicting inferences.
Let me just follow that up, because I'm interested in several things in this case, but I'm interested in the summary judgment methodology also. And in the Ziegler case, in its conclusion, of course, it noted that at page 611, it noted that apparently the parties agree on the historical facts of their relationship, but what they really disagree on are the inferences, that is, the court said, about they disagree about the factual inferences, and ergo the legal conclusions to be drawn therefrom. And so, as I look at this case, there may, much like Ziegler, there may be agreement as to historical facts. There may be no genuine issue of material fact with regard to historical facts, but an argument seems to be made that there is a disagreement as to a genuine issue regarding the factual inferences that can be drawn. For instance, one of the facets of Ziegler is the personnel devoted to the alleged dealership by the grantee. If I recall correctly, and I may be wrong on this, but maybe they have, let's say, four employees that go out and deal with their contractors regularly and deliver supplies once a week and, you know, I'm sure, you know, do things with the April Air product and the historical fact that they might have four employees that do certain things may not be controverted, but the inference from that historical fact that regarding the personnel devoted to the alleged dealership by the grantee and whether or not when they go to the grantor, whether or not they really are doing it to assist the dealership, you know, I put that in quotes, or to for some other reason. I mean, aren't there inferences that can be drawn from their conduct of the once-a-week visit to the contractors? And one side says, yeah, we're promoting this product, and the other side says, no, you're not, or whatever.
Based on the record that was made by this plaintiff, Your Honor, I would say there are no inferences beyond the fact that they called on a regular basis in the course of all of their sales efforts and took orders and put forth products. And if there was a new product, they would show them what the new product is. They were salesmen en route. There are not, for example, facts or evidence with respect to training or certification or how much of their time on these calls was spent on one product or another. Or, for example, that this represents an investment because additional personnel were hired to carry this line. Or, as some courts have looked, are there specialized personnel that you hired that represent an investment which would give the grantor some kind of leverage, which we think would be unfair, and the public policy Mr. Hillebrand speaks of, would be triggered? Are you giving the grantor some kind of additional leverage which would change the equities of the situation and bring in the legislative intent? We don't have that here. We have something that's very similar to, as the court has said, a vendor-vendee relationship. We have salespeople who are going out selling products, a distributor that says, I'm making my run, what do you want to have today? We don't have, for example, advertisements being done. We don't have all kinds of evidence of joint sales calls, one joint sales call in 2.5 years, I believe the evidence is. We don't have open houses to introduce new products. We don't have something that suggests that these personnel were doing something extra beyond what any vendor-vendee in a selling relationship would be doing. And so the best inference you can have is that while they were out selling, they were trying to sell these products as well. If there was more, that evidence could have been put in the record, and it was not.
You would, if Central is not a dealer, are any of April Air's distributors dealers in the state of Wisconsin?
Your Honor, I don't have all the facts on that. I don't believe they would be, but I don't know, for example, percentages of sales, revenues, or profits. I don't know if others, in fact, have invested in some sort of specialized asset. I doubt it. I believe this is more of a distributor relationship, the kind of loose relationship, no written contract, buying and selling over time that the Court of Appeals was looking at in Goudrejon, for example.
Counselor, what about if Central decided to split its corporation and it decided that the part called Central is only going to sell April Air, that's going to be its only business, and it's going to sell it to its sole subsidiary, non-Central, who is now the operation that provides furnace packages to folks to install them. would they be then a dealer, in your opinion, if 100% of the sales of this particular corporation is now April Air?
I'm thinking that such a subterfuge wouldn't really meet the statutory intent, but also I think it was in Ziegler, I'm not positive. There was some discussion of artificially dividing the market. For example, your question about were these 100% of their humidifier sales. I believe in Ziegler, one of the parties, the purported dealer, tried to make that argument that these represent most of our sales of mining equipment or something like that, and the court said, we're not going to encourage you to play those kind of games and make artificial distinctions. We're looking at percentage of the sales as a whole, for example. And I think in both Ziegler and Baldwin, the court used that wording. So to try to artificially separate it out and create some kind of a market, I think probably would not satisfy this court and would be obvious, some kind of a pretext. If we had a company which from the start had dealt in only one product, had made investments to sell only one product, that might be different. I think then we'd have a different case before the court.
Central was able to sell other brands. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, when the notice of termination, there was only one other product or competing product that Central had chosen to sell, which was a thermostat, but there were no restrictions, and that's uncontroverted. When the notice of termination was received, Central was contacted by one supplier of humidifiers, Scuttle, I believe it's called, and also signed a contract with a replacement line, Honeywell, and placed an order, but Honeywell indicated at that point, until this dispute was resolved, they weren't going to supply it. So Central, in fact, did take steps to obtain a replacement line and be able to sell that in the market.
Okay, but now your company sells automatic humidifiers?
Yes.
Air cleaners?
Yes.
Electronic thermostats,
zone
control, ventilation, carbon monoxide alarms, dehumidifiers, germicidal lamps. And only one of those, did Central Corporation sell all of those?
I don't believe they sold everything in the line. My recollection from the record was that zone controls, which were a relatively new product where you can regulate the temperature in different parts of the home, for example, I think they carried that, but were not selling very many of them. And I can't think if there is a specific type of product which they did not carry at all. But it's reasonably clear from the record that the primary product they were concerned with was the humidifier, and that's the one they went out looking for a replacement. They also carried the thermostat, as I say, but I think they were primarily selling the Honeywell thermostat. Thought it was a better price or something like that in the record.
Well, to what extent should the fact that there was, appears to have been, substantial brand loyalty on the part of Central Corporation to April Air, to what extent is that a factor in this?
I suppose in this totality of circumstances, and the court in Ziegler says to look at that, that's a factor which can be considered. However, I read Ziegler to be more concerned with obligations which are being placed on both parties, the mutuality involved, by this relationship. A dealership is defined as a contract or agreement. And although in Ziegler the court talks of looking at activities between the parties, and I would submit perhaps to suggest there's some implied agreement over time, fundamentally we have to look at what actual agreements there were, as that may give the grantor this kind of leverage or unfair bargaining power. And if the distributor could voluntarily do all sorts of activities and, in effect, bootstrap itself into these protections, that would not give the grantor the kind of certainty or ability to predict whether it is held to the statute or not, whether it needs good cause or not. So when the grantor enters into a contract, it can, for example, say we're going to have this interdependence, I'm going to have obligations, and in return I understand that the dealership law will place additional restrictions on our conduct. Or the grantor manufacturer may say, we want a straightforward distributor relationship, we're not going to give you an exclusive territory, we've been selling in this area for years before you were there, we have other people selling. We'll give you flyers, for example, that you can give to your customers to help sell, but you're not required to do that. We're not going to make you have best efforts or a quota or something like that. And so if at that point the dealer says, well, I'm not going to handle anything else. I like your product. That's fine. That's the distributor's choice. But the grantor should then not be held somehow to these restrictions because it has not placed them. It has not created this investment and so created the unfair leverage or bargaining power that the legislature was concerned about. Baldwin talks about either a substantial percentage of sales or revenue, such as lost profits, or substantial dependence, and looks at a substantial investment. And we would submit that the touchstone of this ought to be the agreement between the parties and not what the distributor voluntarily decides for whatever reason. It may be not brand loyalty, but they simply didn't want to carry more than one. Maybe they only carried one furnace line, too, and they thought that was easier for distribution or warehousing or computer records, whatever it is. It doesn't mean that they've therefore devoted all their efforts to only one product. This is a multi-line distributor. I believe Mr. Gertz said they carry products from 50 to 60 suppliers, and I think they say they have 20 different lines of products. And although that does not mean that a multi-line seller, an American TV, could not be a dealer under some circumstances, the more products that they carry and the smaller the percentage of profits or investments or effort that goes to this one product, the less likely it is a dealer. The less likely there is the interdependence or the continuing financial interest. And we have the 20 years is continuing. We grant that. But vendors and vendees may have 20 years, too. If one goes to Target and looks for Bic pens, they probably carried Bic pens for 20, 30 years. But it's doubtful that in a retailer with thousands of products, one would contend that they're automatically a Bic dealer because they've carried this one particular pen for that period of time.
Counselor, what effect, if anything, should we give research's concern and admonition to Central not to be selling April Airs in Madison and the Milwaukee area?
Your Honor, there's kind of an unusual spin on that, I think, in looking at the summary judgment analysis, and that is both parties in the record have said there's no territory here. I looked at that again, and it's in depositions, it's in affidavits. Central says, but we sell within a territory that's about a day's truck drive from our headquarters. And research has said, we talk about markets. We like somebody selling in a market. So we don't have a geographic locale, and nothing is exclusive anyway. But we want you selling in the Fox River Valley. We don't want you coming down to Madison where the contractors can't get the supplies the same way they can if you have a local warehouse. And the reasonable inference that the plaintiff Central would have you derive is that there's no territory. And yet when it comes time for the analysis, they say, but if research is right, there is a territory. So they're kind of arguing at cross purposes. I'd submit either way, that's not sufficient with the other facets to create a dealership. Probably the most important part of the territory facet for Ziegler is it exclusive? Have these parties bound themselves in such a way that the grantor is much more dependent on the distributor and vice versa? They're marketing, they're distributing, they're carrying out all these activities, and they're solely dependent on this one distributor in the territory. And the larger the territory, I think, from some of these decisions, the more important it becomes in this dealership analysis. Well, here we don't have an entire state, and we don't have an exclusive territory. In fact, we have, I believe, 8 other distributors selling in this area. And there's also no testimony, no evidence that Central opened up this market. Research has been selling in the state of Wisconsin for 50 to 60 years. Central says we've been selling for 20 years. There's no evidence that research was not selling in the Fox River Valley during that time period. So we don't have a territory that was opened up, and we don't have a territory that is solely serviced by this one company. Therefore, they don't have that kind of interdependence. Council states that research is solely dependent upon the distributor to get these products to market. Well, on the distribution network, that is true. On this one party, that is not true. Research obviously decided that they could do without this one party. In fact, a business decision was they would be better without the party because there are so many other distributors in the area. And sometimes less is better. The other distributors are more focused than if they all have to split up the pie. In this case, we have, I think, 6% to 7% of the sales within that district come from Central. on this record, and both Central and Research believe that Research will end up having most of those sales, even without Central. So that suggests there isn't this bonding between Central and these contractors. What's really happening is that Research has been marketing to the public to ask for these particular humidifiers and marketing to these contractors to also carry and install these humidifiers. It does that by way of district managers who make many calls, and that's in the record, more calls on the contractors than on the distributors. It does that by promotions to these contractors. For example, put the control for the humidifier and we'll print your name so that when something goes wrong, they'll call you to fix their April Air humidifier. And it does so by cooperative advertising, where Research generates television commercials, the commercials go out, and Research pays for it, and so does the particular contractors. Not Central, they don't pay for it, their name isn't there. So the primary marketing is being done by Research and not by the perhaps brand loyal Central in that area.
I guess my question really went, and that's all very interesting, went to the restriction, and should the restriction have any effect upon our decisions? I understand it's not enough of a factor to make a decision on, but should it have any effect on our decision?
I think it can be considered that Research does not have nationwide distributors, that Research has some limits as its chosen distribution system to serve its customers. It doesn't sell through the Internet. It doesn't have catalog houses. It doesn't have those things. But I would submit that it doesn't weigh strongly in favor of a community of interest in this case. And I think applying the Ziegler test, each facet is looked at, the facts are applied, and the court does a weighing in this totality of the circumstances to decide, does that suggest there's a community of interest or not? And I think that's what we find in the reported decisions. I think that's what this court attempted to do in Ziegler. And I think for a different test situated in this state, that's what the court was looking at doing, but concluded it could not in Baldwin with a new test. And that's what I think the district courts, who have the only reported trial court decisions, have tried to do.
On the number of dealerships, is that in the state or in the Fox Valley area?
The distributors? I believe that what Research does for its internal purposes is it divides the country into various districts. Wisconsin has more than one district. I can't tell you offhand how many. Might be two, might be three. And in this district, which I think is 240, there are, I believe, nine distributors, including Central, which are selling in that area. It includes the Fox River Valley, but it is broader than the Fox River Valley. And I can't tell you exactly what those geographic limitations are. That may well be in the record, but it is not a given territory. And on that, the parties agree that there aren't boundary lines like we see in some cases, these counties and so forth.
Is it relevant at all to know, I used the word dealership before and I shouldn't have used that, distributorship. Is it relevant to know the relative seniority among dealerships, the number in a particular area or not? I mean, because I assume that's the grantor's decision. The company like Research.
I think it may be relevant in a given case if we look at, is this the oldest of the distributors and it built this territory? For example, I think in the Guderjan case, the Court of Appeals says, this particular company introduced the product to the market and built it up. They still found there was no community of interest, but at least they said that suggests the possibility of a community of interest. We don't have that here. The more distributors there are in a given area, and the less exclusive, in effect, the less dependent that the grantor is in this mutuality that's required, and the less the purported dealer or distributor is contributing. So that if this was a distributor that was perhaps doing 95% of the sales in the market and had introduced the market to this product and built it single-handed by its diligent efforts, which were quantified on summary judgment with affidavits and correspondence and sales logs and that sort of thing, I think we'd have a very different case. And there it might well be very relevant. In this case, since we do have information about how much of the sales come from this distributor and how many others are serving the market and how much the other distributors will get, and we have evidence suggesting that contractors a lot of times buy on price We even have an affidavit introduced by Central with a customer of theirs saying, gee, I'm not going to be able to buy them from the cheapest distributor. I might have to buy them from somebody else. That suggests that there is no community of interest and makes those factors less important in this case than they might in another. So is it relevant? Yes. Is it extremely relevant in this case? No. And neither side put more in the record on that. If Central thought it was relevant to establishing their dealership case, they certainly could have put it in the record. They did not.
Do you think the federal courts are consistent with Ziegler, inconsistent with Ziegler? If the latter, more helpful to litigants because more certain than Ziegler's totality of the circumstances?
I would submit that the federal courts are attempting to be loyal to Ziegler, and that they are experiencing the same frustration as the courts of this state have had with interpreting and construing the law. This court, Justice Sykes said that when it comes to the dealership law and the application and scope, nothing is easy. And we've had similar pronouncements from this court. It's the most vexing part of the definition. Justice Steinmetz said whether a dealer has a community of interest is the most confusing thing, or words to that effect. I think that the district courts and the Seventh Circuit have had the same experience, and what they've tried to do is follow the pronouncements of this court. I take them to be acting in good faith. For example, early cases dealt with manufacturers' representatives. Federal cases came down on both sides. Finally, a decision came from this court which helped determine that issue. In the Forster case, this court was suggesting that 50 to 60% of sales were necessary and were tilting much more towards a traditional franchise. And so the Seventh Circuit was looking at illiquid assets and losing your investment. This court then came down with Ziegler and said, no, we're not going to have a bright line test. And we're also going to be looking at the investment and the obligations and whether there's interdependence. And the Seventh Circuit said, okay, we're not going to just look at illiquid assets. That's only one thing we'll look at, whether we have an investment and what the nature of the investment is. The Seventh Circuit said, we're trying to look at the public policy here. This is a difficult statute. We perceive what the legislature said and the Wisconsin Supreme Court said is, do we have a significant investment, a financial investment, and do we have, a significant percentage or substantial percentage of revenues or profits such that the grantor gets this leverage? And when you look at those two particular points, that sounds very much like what this court said in dicta, arguably, but said in Baldwin, that we're looking at sinking resources. I believe the statement is, when a dealer sinks substantial resources into its relationship with a particular grantor or derives substantial revenue from the relationship as a percentage of its total or some combination, then the power to terminate and so forth becomes a substantial threat. And I would also point out in the Bush case, which was decided the same day as Ziegler by this court, the court stated that it is clear that these statutory provisions were enacted for the protection of the interest of the dealer whose economic livelihood may be imperiled by the dealership grantor, whatever its size. So not just affected, not just losing some profits, which any vendor or vendee would lose if they lost a product line, but a significant threat to its health. I submit that the federal courts are applying the Ziegler facets and trying to come up with that same question. How substantial is the investment? How substantial is the percentage of the sales? What obligations or indications of interrelatedness are here? And when you go through the district court decisions, they go through the Ziegler analysis and they attempt to track whether evidence on a facet weighs for or against a community of interest, taking the reasonable inferences in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And if the plaintiff, the purported dealer, doesn't put in any evidence on that, such as how much time was spent, then the court cannot find for them on that one particular facet.
Is it two things? Number one, you talk about significant economic impact. That's the test in Ziegler. But in Freeburg, as I recall, the Seventh Circuit takes that to severe economic impact. So there seems to be some kind of changes in approach, some differences in approach, and that difference is sometimes written about.
Excuse me.
I want, again, to go to summary judgment. Is it your position with regard to all Wisconsin Fair dealership cases that if there is no genuine issue of material fact with regard to historical facts, that then you are just dealing with the application of fact to law, and thus Wisconsin Fair dealership cases should always be subject to summary judgment disposition? Is that your position?
I'd like to say that's my position. It's close to that. I think the question is whether there are material issues of fact or there are differences in inferences from those historical facts such that, taking the reasonable inference in the light most favorable to the other party, there could be a dealership. In other words, an example. There's no investment, no financial investment. There is 1% of the sales. There has been less than a year of history between the parties. There are thousands of other products, but the one dispute between the parties is there a one-county territory or a two-county territory? And they disagree because they had a meeting one day in the back of a bar, and they wrote this out on a napkin, and they each had different notes. Okay, there's an issue of fact there. It is not a material issue of fact because taking all the other facets, there's no way that a court would find that there is a community of interest. And I would submit that in this case, I understand my time is done, but
finish your sentence, please.
Okay. In this case, I believe that is what the trial court and the Court of Appeals did. They looked at the evidence that was in the record on these facets and said, even giving the benefit of a doubt on inferences, there is not enough to find a community of interest in a dealership here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to point out two things in the record which came up in Mr. Axe's argument. He referred to the fact that he says Central has 50 or 60 different product lines. Well, if you look at Jim Trunk's affidavit, which is record number 35, you'll see that actually, in terms of suppliers, research is number 5 at about 8%. The galvanized steel supplier is 21, the registers is 16, the furnaces is 15, and the ducts is 12%. I think that's so. It's pretty obvious as to what this business is. It's not an American TV store selling all sorts of stuff. And the other thing I'd like you to consider is it's in record 33, and it's a list of 11 distributors with shipments into Wisconsin, and for the year 2000, which is the last complete year, I think Central was at about 400,000 in the mid-range of their distributors. So for whatever that's worth, I'd want the court to have the benefit of those facts.
Well, what is that for? Is that to show that the research is dependent on Central Corp?
Yes, and it has been for 20 years to get its product. And you see, they view the market as, or research views the market as being territorial, but the market is really the relationships that are built up with installer contractors, because those are the folks that go out and actually sell and install the furnaces and the April air that goes along with it. But there's one critical point that I would really like to respond to, and that is this business where a grantor should be able to specify in the contract whether it's a dealership or not, and if it loads the dealer up with best efforts and all of that stuff, then it's a dealership. But if you have something like here where here you are, you can sell our stuff and you're our distributor, then that's not. Well, I think one thing that the court made clear in Ziegler was that we just don't look at the contract. We look at the economic realities. If my client had 3 or 4 different brands of humidifiers and was selling them, obviously that isn't what happened here, but that is not, and then that would not be a dealership, but simply because the economic realities were that you can only handle one brand, and you can go out and market this brand along with your other stuff to these installer contracts. The economic reality is that you have to push and promote and sell and install that brand and create the goodwill among your customers to do so. And that's exactly what happened here. It's the economic reality of it. But is that unfair to research? No, that's exactly what they expected. And the fact that they didn't have a written contract saying best efforts, the fact that my client engaged not only in best efforts, but above and beyond the call of duty of promoting and installing their product for 20 years, what difference does it make that they weren't required by a contract to use best efforts? The fact of the matter is that they did, and the fact of the matter is that research knew that they did, or if they didn't, they would have terminated them for cause. So this I think the economic realities are what is contemplated by the statute. It's inherent in the whole community of interest test, where we talk about interdependence and financial interest and what is actually going on in the marketplace.
Are there any historical facts upon which you have a dispute?
I don't think so. I mean, the sales are there, but here is one problem that we have. Over their 20-year relationship, my client did not maintain time records about how much time when a salesman goes out does he spend on April Airs opposed to the other things. So my learned opponent says, well, you lose. You know, if you can't show us exactly how much time you put on April Airs compared to your other stuff, you lose. There's nothing in the dealership law that requires that kind of proof or that kind of quantification. And frankly, it's unrealistic and it's unreasonable for that to be required. If that is required, then that defeats the purposes of the law. My client did this best efforts thing for 20 years and was successful in doing it. And I would earnestly ask the court to look at the economic realities, because that's what you're supposed to do with this kind of a statute. Thank you very much. Yes?
May I ask one question, talking about sort of realities? How normal would it be for a company like Research to have a contract with a distributor?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know how other companies operate in this field, but I think that that it's easy to do business without a formalized contract in this kind of an area. It's not a situation that's fraught with a quality control problem like you have in a let's say a restaurant franchise or some other things. All you need is somebody who's going to reliably be there to sell and install and deliver that product to market and push your brand name and all that, because you have a finished good type of item which you are pushing. So all the manufacturer has to do is make sure that when he sells the product, he gets paid for it. And this company has always been paid for it. All the rest of the headaches are on the distributor. And that's why there's independence and financial interest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. Thank you, Mr. Axe, for your presentation today on franchise law that we haven't heard for a while. We will now end our hearing on 02-1974, Central Corp. versus Research Products Corp. The students will remain.